Lake Effect continues now on WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. Writer Paul Harding gave himself a tough act to follow. His first novel, Tinkers, won the Pulitzer Prize in 2010. It took place in northern New England, a locale he returns to in his latest novel, Enon. And the book's protagonist is the grandson of the lead character in the latest novel. But while the stories are far different, the stories both share Harding's impeccable writing skill and his fearless taking on of a subject that most of us would rather avoid, death. Harding, who was in Milwaukee in the fall, tells us that after spending 2 years immersed in the subject and in creating his latest book, it was nice to get out and talk about it in the real world.
The swings of the pendulum are long, and sometimes, you know, but I spent so long out on the road for Tinkers, and then I spent so long sort of practically becoming agoraphobic at my home in north of Boston, just totally immersed every single day in the composition and revision and revision and revision and revision of Enon. And you just spend so much time just with yourself inside the work. But then when it's published, it's a great relief to sort of go back out into the world and you sort of get revivified by just going out and talking with people. And it's such an interesting thing because part of it is, you know, it's, the work of art is solitary and it's just you and the blank page or the blinking cursor or whatever. But, you know, then, you know, a work of art is essentially a gesture of fellowship. You know, so you want to go out and talk with people about reading and writing and art.
Is it at all scary, though, when you spent that much time basically creating something, in this case, that's quite dark but yet also hopeful?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
Yet, you know, are you at all afraid that people are going to reject it?
It's inevitable. I mean, there's always that worry because you do have to go for long periods of time without sort of getting feedback. I mean, my agent gives me feedback and my editor, but that's sort of that's kind of the editorial process. You just wonder when it goes out into the world. You know, of course you're afraid of rejection, but you have to have faith in the idea that if you think it's all right, there's going to be other people who like it. One of the things I always tell my writing students is don't write your books for people who won't like them. You know, because you can get into that, like, oh, well, this kind of person won't like the book. So then the problem is you don't write the real story. You write in anticipation of antagonistic readers, which is just that you won't write a good book that way. You know, the people who like my writing. It's a strange, it's almost tautological. But and then with Enon, yeah, it's I mean, when I first got the idea for it, I thought, oh, good, a spooky New England, you know, ghost story. And I wrote the first page of it and realized, no, this is just an incredibly sad tragedy. It's just a tragedy. It almost makes Tinkers look like a sitcom, you know.
Almost,
you know. But then that just, as a writer, was just this book presenting its own particular challenges. To avoid sentimentality, to avoid melodrama, to avoid, I don't know, just any of the predictable possible pitfalls of writing about that subject matter.
How much can we give away here?
You can give away everything. Spoiler. I mean, I'm solely interested in writing about character. So to me, plot is a predicate of character. So that if you read the first paragraph of Enon, you know what the whole story is. In the same way that the same is true of Tinkers. Mm-hmm. For me as an author, that's just a way of making sure that I don't do any three-card Monty stuff with plot. It's like all the cards are on the table and now the story must be in the telling.
The story is a very simple one and a very sad one, which is that a man loses his only child in a terrible car accident.
Mm-hmm.
It's the rest of the book is about how he does and doesn't deal with it.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
And as you say, it's character. It's mm-hmm. about who this man is.
Yeah, it's his attempt to be – well, to be equal to is maybe not quite the right word, but to how to survive it, how to, from his point of view, live up to the memory of his daughter. He really becomes unraveled and it only gets worse. But he has the constant awareness throughout the whole book that he's unraveling and that he should not be unraveling and that in some ways he feels that unraveling is a betrayal of the memory of his daughter. And so it makes it all the more acute and more painful, but also then all the more imperative for him to try to pull himself back together as a way of doing justice to, you know, he loses his only child, but he's still a parent.
And it doesn't stop his life.
Right. That's right. Almost does. Right. And I mean, and that's you know, it's not really a spoiler alert to say that one of the big question, the fundamental question for him becomes, am I through almost attrition, almost through committing an attenuated kind of suicide by abusing drugs and alcohol and all this sort of stuff that comes up? Is that just a way of trying to sort of split the difference and still just commit suicide? As difficult as it is for him to try to get out of that cycle that he finds himself in, it becomes imperative for him to that's the difference between hope and hopelessness.
And again, like I said at the beginning of this, it's very, very dark, but there is that sense of hope that, you know, he's telling this story. So, you know, you're thinking,
right.
I'm hoping that, you know, when we get to the end, that he has found his way somewhere better.
Right. And the fact that it's first person and he's telling it in retrospect, and the fact that you trust Paul Harding not to pull the rug out from under you in any sort of tricky –
there isn't that three-card Monte.
There is no posthumous first-person narrative. He's alive. He's telling you the story. So somehow or another, he's come out on the other end of it. And as difficult as his story is and as modest, as it were, as the outcome is, it still is ultimately hopeful. And it's meant to be beautiful. And it's a book about love, you know. It's the threat of meaninglessness. It's the threat of total darkness. But just on the principle that, you know, the darkest hour is just before dawn. It's, you know, that just that idea of as dark as things get, that just makes this, even if it's the smallest amount of light that comes into, you know, that illuminates at the end, it's all the more precious and all the more piercing and all the more beautiful for the fact that it resists total darkness.
Yeah, total annihilation.
Right, right.
It's just not an option.
Yeah. I mean, for me as an artist and aesthetically and spiritually and blah, 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 it's just not. Flannery O'Connor, somebody says, you know, like novelists, you know, people without hope don't write novels. They don't make art. You know, so I think that's just a premise that I'm very open about.
What was it like being locked in with this story, though, for 2 years?
Oh, it's really intense. I mean, at first I thought, oh, goody, I've got a ghost story. I've got a New England ghost story on my hands. So it's Hawthorne and Poe and Emily Dickinson, and they're all certainly in there. But then I wrote the first paragraph of the book, and I realized this is a tragedy. This is just sort of this. I mean, there's no euphemistic way to get it. I'm writing a tragedy. And so I immediately just thought about, you know, every story takes part in a long tradition, and that, you know, this is Orpheus going down to the underworld. It's Persephone and Demeter. It's the parent going to the underworld and because he wants his daughter back, you know. So there's a long, rich history that I could rely on and think about. And also it was just a great way of actually disciplining the writing, because I sort of feel like, why bother trying to write a book if everything's not at stake? So the real danger that I had to work to avoid but became one of the satisfactions of the book, of the composition of the book avoiding, was that if the basic premise of the novel is a parent losing his only child, you take one false step in any direction and you have maudlin, melodramatic, sentimental hogwash. And I just was that won't do. So it just became a way of just disciplining the writing to just stay with this character. It's written in first person, so to stay with this character as he experiences every single moment and not lapse into writing about things abstractly. So he grieves, but the book is not about grief. The book is about Charlie Crosby. It's about the protagonist. Because the moment you lapse into just writing about grief in a kind of theoretical or abstract or psychological way, you know, objective way, the value of it as a work of art, it's a very slippery slope.
I think it distances you from the actual thing you're trying to talk about.
Right, which is a human being. I'm trying to render a human soul. And every human soul must be granted its own experience of itself. So you can't come up with an idea of like what grief is per se and then spend the novel forcing the character to experience the predetermined definition you have of grief. You obliterate his humanity. You insult the reader. And, you know, you write a crummy novel, basically.
Right. Which is the last thing we want.
That's the last thing I want, too. Believe me, we all want the same thing, you know, a good work of art.
In addition to being locked in your room with a very dark but hopeful story, mm-hmm. this also came after Tinkers, which we mentioned, which won you all kinds of very deserved accolades. Was there a pressure there for you to try to somehow repeat that?
There is, but it's a worldly pressure, and this is the sort of distinction you just have to make or you'll just be paralyzed, which is there's a predictable phenomenon that comes along with if you have a first book and the first book is very popular, people are going to be ready for the sophomore slump. There's going to be as many people who don't like the book because it's Tinkers 2 or don't like it because it's not Tinkers 2 or whatever. And as a writer, you just can't think about any of that. I was going to be, no matter how well or poorly Tinkers did, I was going to be trying to write the best possible second novel I could. So when Tinkers won the Pulitzer and there was this big kind of worldly phenomenon around it, I just had to make sure that every day when I climbed down into the fictional world of Enon, that all of that just went away, you know, didn't have any of that in my mind. And in that sense, I, you know, it was very, very helpful that I, you know, have a wonderful agent and a wonderful editor at Random House who just abetted me in writing the book that I wanted to write and just like help keep the sort of aesthetic integrity of, you know, like the sort of just the realm of the book of Enon separate from kind of all the other worldly stuff that was going on around it. So, I mean,
and you feel it was successful?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I mean, sometimes, you know, sometimes as a private citizen, when I was lying in bed at 4 a.m, I think, oh my goodness, I've got to do this. You know, how am I going to do? But that's just, I mean, that's inevitable. But again, it's just then the minute, you know, you put your writing hat on, all that stuff just, because every ounce of energy or every brain cell that's distracted about what am I going to do, you know, following up that first novel or the second novel is something that's distracting you from what you should be rightly paying attention to, which is this guy, this book, his, what does he see right now? What does he feel right now? Where is he going? How does he feel? I mean, every single bit of your attention has to be devoted to the character at hand.
It's a wonderful book.
Oh, thank
you so
much.
It's so evocative, so beautiful, and so painful. It was so hard to go with him on that journey because you just kept – at least I kept feeling, oh, you know, I want – but then I knew he had to do what he had to do because otherwise, as you said, it would have been false.
Right.
If he had come out of it too soon, it would have felt like, oh, wait, that was too easy. You know?
Oh, yeah, right, yeah. Right. Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And I'm sure – or maybe not, but certainly as a reader, there were times where I thought, oh, just – you know, go there, but you know in real life that wouldn't happen.
Right. And then that's the deeper sense of, you know, I think a lot about John Keats and the formulation of truth is beauty and beauty is truth, which is that the book is finally beautiful and therefore generous and solicitous of the reader because its integrity comes from it staying true to its own subject and not pulling punches or not being euphemistic, not glossing over things so that as intense as this sort of journey with the protagonist might be, at the end you do feel joy and hope and you feel like you've just gone through a true experience, you know. My job as a writer is to blow your mind and to break your heart. And that's just by taking this human life seriously and by also basically saying yes to it, you know. Wallace Stevens, the poet, said that poetry is essentially saying yes to this world and our place in it. And that's what I feel like my job and my natural disposition is for every book that I write.
Paul Harding, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Paul Harding's latest novel is Enon. His previous book, Tinkers, won the 2010 Pulitzer Prize for Fiction. Harding, who lives near Boston, was in Milwaukee last fall, and he spoke with us then. Our interview with him first aired in early December. You can hear Paul Harding read from Enon at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks, as always, for tuning in today. Be sure to be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect. It's on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh air comes your way next.